Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urison.
Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My next guest today is a very interesting story he has. He started doing something when he was in college to pay for the college. And he started trying to make money. And in the process, he discovered a niche. So today, we're going to learn what that is and how he's exploiting that and leveraging it. It's become more than, of course, since then he's graduated and he's the co-founder of Books Pro. And we're going to learn all about it. And when he's not working, he likes to fly small planes and enjoy life. So with that, welcome to the show, Omar. Omar Mohit, how are you doing?
Hello. Thank you, Nick, for inviting me to your podcast. I'm doing great. How about you?
Oh, good, good. So I'm dying to hear about your story. So tell me this thing that you discovered when you were in college. Tell us what that was and how you actually leverage it.
Yeah, sure. My niche is selling books on Amazon. I started selling my own books on Amazon. I started in...
What kind of bookstore?
It's every kinds of books. We now have textbooks, reference, fiction, thriller, mystery, kids book, you name it.
So these are new or used?
So most of our books are used. We buy as in truckloads from chains like Goodwill, Salvation Army, Savers, and some other local chains.
So you were talking about hardcover books, so it's nothing to do with publishing or anything like that.
No.
This is not about the books that you've written yourself. So
no.
Right? So because, you know, Amazon is a huge platform, so it's legitimate business. But mm-hmm. we're talking about strictly sourcing hardcover books for the purposes of selling them on Amazon.
Yes. Yes, I did not publish any book. I am selling the ones that already has existing demand. And they are hard copy physical books, yes.
Okay. So I want you to explain something that you described to me. And I actually did not, frankly, think about it the way that you put it. So there are two business models on Amazon. So people listening to this show, they're going to say, oh, it's an online arbitrage guy. So there is private label selling and there is online arbitrage. So basically you mm-hmm. source products and then you find something that's going to make you money, source it, and then list it on an existing listing and then sell it.
Mm-hmm.
You are neither one of these models. You're clearly not private label, but also you're not online arbitrage. This is a totally different business model, right? So tell us about that. What is that?
Yes. So the two different business models you mentioned, the first one is private labeling. You need to do your own marketing. There is no existing demand. You create the demand for that niche. And my product line is some part of retail arbitrage, and we don't do online arbitrage. We buy products that has already existing demand that's already selling. So we try to come up with a system that we can process faster, and create a big volume.
So how is that different than online arbitrage?
So the arbitrage is basically buying products to resell for a profit. In retail arbitrage, you go to a retail store to find the products to sell online. It might be a Walmart, a Target, thrift store, or garage sales. We started at this business model. We were physically visiting stores and scanning items to sell online. And in online arbitrage, you find the products online and resell them online for a profit. But in our business model, we build relationship with our sources. We buy as in bulk, like in each shipment, we have over 30,000 of unique titles of books.
I see. So the difference is online arbitrage is you are simply going into sources. You are going to your sources for the purposes of buying stuff so that you can sell it at a competitive price online.
I have many friends that are doing online arbitrage. They are basically trying to find deals, coupons on the website. And then they are making purchases and then they resell.
Okay. This is almost like reverse, you know, in the old days, we had auctions. Auctions basically meant that you would go to an auction and then you would try to buy the item at a buyer. Offering a higher price, and then finally it would be sold to somebody, and then they create reverse auctions. Reverse auctions was about trying to bid on something. So this is almost like reverse online arbitrage, because in your business model, retailers are approaching you to sell it online, right?
Could you elaborate on that?
Like in your case, if you go to, let's take the first model, online arbitrage, you are going into wherever you're buying from, and you are purchasing the item because you want to sell it online. And whoever you are purchasing from, it's not really their business where you're going to sell it. As long as it's a legitimate sale, they're just happy to sell it to you. And then it ends up online. But in your model, in retail arbitrage, retailers or whoever you are purchasing this from, they know that they are creating an online channel through you. That's what they are doing, right? So that's why I'm saying it's almost like a reverse.
I understand what you mean. Yes, our sources, they have excessive amount of donations. They get a lot of books. They try to process those at their online, at their retail stores. But since they are excessive amount of items, they also sell those in bulk to other retailers like us.
Okay, so these are not, you're not buying anything from wholesalers or distributors. You're buying it specifically from organizations that are basically donation based.
Exactly, yes.
In some cases, maybe nonprofit.
Most of them are nonprofit. Some of our sources is selling other product lines like clothing, shoes, rags, and they also get donations of books, CDs, DVDs, video games, and they resell that in bulk to us.
Okay, so you are almost doing service to them, right? Because otherwise, what's their choice? Their choice is, you know, whatever they receive in donations or whatever they need to sell it through their outlets. But now through you, you've become a channel for them. And
yes.
And that is the reason why you call it retail arbitrage.
Yes, we create convenience for them because they need space and they have lack of labor. When they need space urgently, they give us a call and we send the truck in the same day most of the times, and then we move their load.
So the items that they buy, that you buy from them, this is I remember these are not one of a kind items either. You're buying the same item in quantity, right?
So most of our items are unique and they are blind shipment. We don't know what we are buying.
I see.
We are receiving over 30,000 of items, which is 99% unique SKUs.
And okay, so if these are unique items, it's almost like that's what you do on eBay generally. So mm-hmm. when you compare Amazon to eBay, which one is a better one?
I wish I could say eBay because I am so tired of Amazon's monopoly, but Amazon is still the number one.
Really?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Okay, so
and so then, that may also depend on the business strategy. In my current business, Amazon is our number one source of income, but I have some friends that are mostly doing on eBay. So it may depend on the business strategy.
So walk me through this. So you receive a shipment mm-hmm. and it's, let's take this scenario where you mentioned blind shipment. And
yes.
and let's say that these are all unique items. So how do you know what has a listing on Amazon and what doesn't?
So most of them has listings on Amazon, and we created a system, a conveyor belt system. And on the back end, it has a lot of rules and it's comparing the payouts. We also sell as in wholesale. It makes a lot of comparisons along the way on the conveyor belt. And it makes the decision at the end of the conveyor belt, whether we are going to do FBA or merchant fulfilled or wholesale them or selling it to the recycle.
I see. So what is the share with us some of the sorting, so to speak? What determines this is good for FBA, good for FBM, and good for, you mentioned wholesale.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that means that you need to assign a price for it, right?
That's a good question. Our rules are based on the lowest offers. So we make our decisions based on that. We take the lowest merchant fulfilled offers, lowest FBA offers, and the offer that buyback companies are giving for that specific item. There is an optic reader on top of the conveyor belt. For each item, it goes below that optic reader, it scans the ISBN barcode, which is the identifier for books. It's the type of EAN barcode. And it sends that ISBN number to Amazon servers through BooksPro. And then it makes the decision based on the comparison of what would be the payout based on fulfillment by Amazon, based on merchant fulfilled and the buyback companies. And it's giving the final decisions on that. And there are also some correlations between the sales rank, sales velocity. So if it is a high sales velocity item, we prefer to sell it on Amazon. If it's a long tail item, we prefer that to be sold to buyback company because we get paid faster. So there are a lot of correlations and a bunch of rules to make that determination.
I see. So the wholesale, you also mentioned you sell wholesale. So how do you sell it wholesale when it's a unique item, one of a kind?
That's a great question. There are a bunch of buyback companies like sellbackyourbook.com, ziffit.com, pavels.com, textbookrush.com. There are a bunch of buyback companies that is working specifically for book resellers, and they make offers for a specific item. For each scan, we also send those ISBNs to them through APIs, and then they make offers.
And these offers are predetermined, or is it on demand?
that is dynamically changing based on their demands.
I see. So if I give you a book right now, let's say that you and I are sitting across the table and I say, here is a book, tell me the best option. You're going to put that through your Books Pro system, and then immediately you can tell how much you're going to make on FBA based on who is in the buy box and who has the lowest price, right?
Kind of, yeah. They are all assumptions. We are assuming that we will be get paid if we sell this item as fulfilled by Amazon, if we sell this item as merchant fulfilled, and selling to the buyback company is not the assumption part in this equation. So their offer is locked in. So if they make an offer for a book, they for sure, at least they claim that, for sure they pay that amount for that book.
Okay. So, okay, I have a few different things. This is an interesting business model because I have, I talk to many, many sellers, and there's all kinds of different types of sellers. For example, you have sellers who are, they're selling consumer brands, their own private label, but they're looking to create a direct-to-consumer channel because they have a supply chain. So that's one type of seller. Another type of seller is a seller that's exclusively selling online. They sell through website. They sell through private label again. You have also online arbitrage. You have people who do both. This is a different option. Yeah. However, all of these things come down to looking at the data. So in your case, there is something here that I want to understand. First of all, you are never creating a listing, right? You are always going to exist.
Yes, that's correct. Okay.
So what if there is nobody, because there are so many listings with the ISBN that comes up, says currently unavailable. What happens then?
So if there is no listing, we assume that there is relatively low demand on this item and it becomes a reject. So we never create a new listing.
I see. So if there is unless
it is an antiquarian item, like a collectible ones, first edition, signed by author, we have a different procedure for those kind of items. We create the listings, take pictures of the items, determine the price manually. But other than that, everything is determined with automation.
Okay. So what I'm understanding is, unless it's one of those special ones, any listing that comes up unavailable, you just assume it's a low demand item and you know that you're not going to sell this.
Yes. Okay. So there are 30 million unique titles in books category, and I would say 99% of them has existing listing.
Okay. So and out of that 99%, would you know how many of them are available?
It's hard to tell. So if it's a brand new listing just published by the publisher, it may be the case, but this rarely happens because we get the items used and it takes some time to, like, someone is going to buy from the publisher, they're going to read, they're going to donate to some nonprofit organization, and it's going to come to us. It takes some process, and it rarely happens.
Yeah. So would you say out of that 30 million listings, half of them would be currently selling, or would it be less?
It's hard to tell. So the sales rank is basically they have tendency to be dropped. As soon as they have a tail on that listing, Amazon's algorithm takes that tail string to the to a slower number, and then they start to tank again. They go bigger number, and then another sale happens, then they go higher. So if an item is sitting at 10 million sales rank, that means not even a single sale happened in the last 6 months, I would say that.
Okay. All right. So, you are able to tell, you're looking for a price, and if there is no price, that's not saleable as far as you are concerned. And if there is price, then you are determining if it's FBA, FBM, how much it will make you.
So this is a different case. If there is an existing listing, but there is no price to base the decision from, this is a different case. So we assume that no sellers on the listing would be a reject. But if there is a couple sellers, but we cannot make the decision based on if there is no FBA sellers, we have backup rule. If there is no FBA ones, then it goes to a backup rule. If there is no that, it goes to a backup rule. We try to make the most money, most dollar value out of it if there is a seller on that listing.
Okay.
In most cases, that may be an accept if that is a still profitable item.
Okay. So does this mean you are doing your own fulfillment all the time, or do you send any of the items to Amazon for fulfillment by Amazon?
That's a great question. The reason that we are our main source of income is Amazon, because we leverage the program called FBA, Fulfilled by Amazon. So we let Amazon do the most of the work. Our 80% of our business model is FBA. We have over 100,000 units at fulfillment center. At Amazon's fulfillment center, and we also do merchant fulfilled as well. We make the decision. So Amazon has different criteria. If it's a fast moving item, we send that to FBA. If it's a slow moving item, we rather do that as merchant fulfilled, because there is a metric called FBA sell through rate, and Amazon may hurt our restock limit if our sell through rate is low, because they want to operate in an optimal way. If they reach the capacity, they're gonna cut down some limits of some sellers. So we want to optimize that as well.
Yeah. I mean, your inventory performance index is key. So they don't want to be a warehouse for storage. Mm-hmm. They want to be constantly churning merchandise on behalf of sellers. So any seller who keeps merchandise there that doesn't sell a long time will pay extra storage, and mm-hmm. and they don't really like that. So I understand that. So so that means that you are receiving shipments, mm-hmm. putting them through your Books Pro system, and that Books Pro system tells you this is the way to do it, and then you ship the merchandise to Amazon FBA.
And then I can give you some numbers. We receive the shipments, we process all of them. So we touch our staff, touch every single item in the shipment. They place that on the belt, either they just throw it away if it's the incomplete book. So we process those items, we send those information to Amazon and get the decision through Books Pro. And if it's still profitable, we try to make the most money out of it. If I give you numbers, approximately 17% out of the shipment is accepted that we do retailing. Either we do FBA or merchant fulfilled. We do 10 to 15% as in wholesale to other buyback companies. And I would say the rest is recycling. So most of them, like 70%, 60 to 70% of the books we purchased, we are selling to recycle.
And how does that compare in terms of your cost? So because normally when you buy stuff, you know, you have a cost of goods sold, and then when you sell it, you have the sale price, and then you have your mm-hmm. margin. So in your case, you're selling lots, and then mm-hmm. you're buying lots, and then you are capitalizing on each item individually. So if you consider the lot as your single item, so to speak,
mm-hmm. yes,
and you look at the cost of that. So in this business model, what kind of margins are you achieving? Can you share with us some mm-hmm. as an indication?
Sure. So in let me illustrate the my business model a little bit. We do both cherry picking and bulk. So if it's bulk, if it's cherry picking, as you said, we do the cost of goods, the item purchase price. So as in bulk, we pay by the weight. We pay like a couple cents. Sometimes it's even 1 cent per pound of books. Sometimes it's 10 cents. And we pay that upfront and we try to make the most money out of it. We don't put cost of goods sold. And we also track each load that we received. We track the money that we get out of it to track the performance and to prioritize the quality of the item. Let's say there are more than one source to say they have one load available. Then we check our reports. We know which one is more profitable and we go with one of them, which is more profitable. And I can give you some margins. So around 44% of the gross sales are the payout. Around 25% is the gross profit margin. And I would say 10% is the net profit margin.
So 10%, the net profit is out of, so the way you are calculating that is how much you collected collectively mm-hmm. across everything, FBA, FBM, buyback people all together, how much you collected minus how much you mm-hmm. paid.
So we make around $600,000 a month, roughly. So 44% of that money is the payout. And then some of them is the cost of goods sold. So 25% is the gross profit that I subtract the cost of goods sold. And I would say 10% of the gross sales is the net profit margin.
Okay. And so my favorite question always is, as a financial metric to track, what is the value of inventory you're carrying at all times that you paid out?
Across all of the accounts, I would say around 2.5 million.
So you see, there is a problem there, right? Because if you're generating, 60,000 a month,
it's 10%. No, it's 600,000 a month.
No, 600,000 is the sale. And then from mm-hmm. that, you have 10% net margin, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that gives you 60,000.
Roughly, yes.
So if you have 60,000 in your pocket, but you have $2.5 million in inventory, it takes...
But that is in sales, not the cost of goods.
Oh, okay. No, I'm asking the value, how much you paid out of pocket. How much are you...
I don't know that metric. I track the...
But you want to know that, man. You want to know that
metric. We can say maybe 10% of that, even less.
10%?
If we say 10%, $250,000.
Okay, fine. That's a much, much more reasonable. But you know, that still presents a problem. Because for 5 months, you're going to go without seeing a penny because your earnings will finance the inventory.
But we are still growing. We reinvest.
No, listen.
To acquire more inventory.
Sure. Well, exactly. My point exactly. That means you actually need to go 6-7 months without seeing any cash in your pocket because you're growing. So this is an interesting situation. It's a fact of life. It's a fact of life. There is nothing wrong with it.
Yes.
The only thing that sellers, I always encourage them to think this way is because when you are in an inventory business, fact of life, you have to carry inventory. Another fact of life, you have to carry more inventory than what you sell every month because you buy ahead of time. Fact of life, you make money on every sale. So now what happens is you need to know real time at all times how much, we call it liquidity, how much liquidity you generated every month and compare that to the total value out of pocket, cost of goods sold, you know, what you paid out for the inventory that you are holding. This is, I looked for a definition for this in terms of, you know, what do you call this? What is this? Is this, this is clearly a metric, but what do you call? Nobody gave me a straight answer. So I coined my own phrase. I call it return on inventory. Return on inventory means that how much you paid out of your pocket that you are holding right now, and what are you generating out of that on monthly basis? So if you are in growth mode, that means that you have to anticipate your growth and buy more inventory. Okay. So therefore, what that presents is a situation where you will generate X number of dollars every month, and 5, 6, 7, 8 times that is going to be the value of the inventory you are holding. That means that you need to arrange your funding in a way that it will cover the shortfall, because otherwise you risk your business because you are constantly running out of cash.
Yeah, I understand. So you think my inventory value is a lot more than what we make?
The inventory value you are holding at any point in time is a lot more than what you make in a month.
Yeah, I understand. And let me explain that. So since we paid all the load cost upfront, we try to make the most money out of it. If there is a let's think of a hypothetical book that may sell for $100. So there is a very slight chance that may sell, but we still list it because we have already paid for it. So we can do, so if we, if I take that advice, we can also make that $1 million of inventory, worth of inventory, but it would be some waste of inventory to just throw away because we have already paid for it. We already list the items that may never be sold.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, but that's the value of the inventory that you are, at the end of the day, you know, if you sell it, so there's another concept. You want to know what is the value of the inventory that has not sold in the last 90 days, 60 days, 30 days. So what you want, so take the ideal situation. You buy one piece today. And then by the end of the month, you sell that piece.
Okay.
And right at the end of the month, you receive another piece, knowing that that's what you're going to sell. And then you sell that piece. That means you have no problems because you held the inventory only for a month. If you paid it at the beginning of the month, at the end of the month, by selling it, you are going to get back the cost that you paid for it, plus you'll make money. And then you buy the second one. But it never works that way because you're never going to sell out and then receive it on the first of the next month, especially if with FBA.
Yeah.
So you are holding. You are always holding more inventory. So if you hold two pieces to be ready for next month, now it's double the amount of you are generating in profit, right? So
you are making a great point, but please understand that we only have only one copy of most of the items. So if we receive more units for the same item, this may not be accepted. We may just throw away. We may not put that in the inventory. But like 99%, maybe more, of the inventory we have is all unique. We do not know if this one is gonna sell or the other one is gonna sell. We of course do some cleaning, inventory cleaning. If it has been a while that this item is not sold, we create coupons, not coupons. We decrease the prices, give it a chance to be sold. If it does not sell, we create removals for those items, whether if it's FBA or merchant fulfilled. We do some cleaning. Yes. We do not list and wait. It does not go infinity. We of course clear out some items out of our inventory.
I mean, that's okay. So if you look at the big picture, that's what I was asking. So let's say you buy one shipment and collectively take the example you gave, $600,000 sold in a month. So out of that 600,000, what you are talking about is whatever sold that month, doesn't matter when you bought it, whatever you sold, how much revenue you generated that month, that's 600,000. So out of that 600,000, what is it that you are taking home net after paying for the whatever you've already bought? Minus the fulfillment fee, minus the Amazon commission, take away everything. Whatever is left is your net margin. So I heard you mentioned 10%. So that's 60,000. Okay. Probably. That is, that is only considering the cost of the stuff that's sold. Stuff that you bought from before that's still waiting, that doesn't enter into this calculation. So this is one calculation. Your net margin or net liquidity for the month is 60,000. So now you turn around and you say, okay, I generated 60,000 this month. Let's assume that you generated the same amount every month. That means in a year, you generated $720,000 net.
Okay.
Now, at the end of the year, let's say that you made all your purchases at the beginning of the year, and then as you make your sales, month one, month two, month three, things are going up, down, whatever, and then you are buying in the meantime, right? You're buying, you're finding new stuff, buying. So now, fast forward to the end of month 12. You know for a fact that you generated 720 grand. It's sitting in the bank, let's say. You never touched it. And also, through the buying process throughout the year, at that same point, you then turn around and say, okay, what is the value of inventory I have right now? Some of it may have just arrived. Some of it may have been bought 3 months ago, 6 months ago, whatever the case. Some of it 2 weeks ago. It doesn't matter. It's the total value. You look at the total value. That's what I was asking. So your number was, I believe, 10% of 2.5 million, 250,000, right? So if it's $250,000 at the end of the year, that means that out of that $720,000 that you made, $250,000 just covers the cost of the merchandise, so that you have extra cash left. But generally, it never works out that way because you're carrying more inventory. So therefore, if you take that snapshot, like for example, take at the end of month one, starting from scratch, you made your purchases, month one closed, you made your $60,000. You turn around, look at how much, what's the value of the inventory you have? The chances are it's more than 60,000.
Yeah, it may be. One of the reasons it happens that way is the price depreciation. So let's say we list an item for $40 and we do not price our items manually. At Booksbro, we have a repricer, automation rules. It just competes with the market value, market price. It competes. There may be a point that $40 book is just $6 and making 20 cents of payout. So we do a lot of clearance process of our inventory.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all those things will go straight to your margin. So I'm assuming by the time you do your discounting and clearing and everything else, you're still leaving with 10% net margin. So they are already factored into it. So I guess the whole point is, because people listening to this show, they're looking for answers. So the kind of people listening are private label sellers, are looking for ways to promote their items more. This is not for them. Housewives, people who are stay-at-home moms. They're looking for a way to generate income and then also spend more time with their family. There's all kinds of different people doing online arbitrage. So now people who are already doing online arbitrage may hear this as an idea. This may be something that I can do. So what you want to take into account with online arbitrage, which is a less of a problem for you, for your model, is in online arbitrage, you buy an item and then you're competing with many other sellers and the price goes straight to the bottom because of their buy box. And then at some point you realize that the inventory you paid for, there is no way you're going to make money. So what happens? You make a loss.
Yeah, you sell it for a loss. Yeah.
Yeah. In your case, since you are paying very little, because it's all through NGOs or, you know, nonprofits, through donation, you pay very little. But then at the end of the day, you are also holding inventory because you are, because there is a good offer. You are going to purchase it and you're going to monetize parts of it, but you are holding. So therefore, in your business model, what I can see is your financials are extremely important to keep very close eye on in terms of what I call your return on inventory, how much liquidity you are generating versus how much inventory you are holding at any point in time, real time. So that way you can say, okay, that metric is turning, you know, against us, which means that you are paying out, but your liquidity you are generating is not enough to cover it. So therefore you need to arrange financing or do something about it, either way. But that to me is key. This is a key metric no matter what, but it becomes less of a threat if you are selling your own products because you are the brand owner. So it's okay, it's your product. But if you are buying and selling, and especially if you are holding, and that means storage and everything else, you want to be more careful and stay on top of this metric. And that's to do it. And also another thing that I see in your case is buy box, you know, what percentage of the buy box are you in it, so that you're not having to compete with others. Is that your experience?
The price tank?
Yeah.
We have seen a lot of price tanks. I've seen a book was decreased from $100 to $8. So the main metric we track is we know how much we paid for a lot. Let's assume that we have paid $5,000 for a lot, and we know how much money we got the payout just by selling those items out of those lots. We track that metric. Let's say we purchased for $5,000, our payout from the items that was in that lot was $15,000, and we still have 1,000 books listed. So we track that performance.
Yeah, I think you should be tracking also your inventory value and compare that against whatever you are making.
Because that's nice advice.
I mean, it's because that's where that's the business.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, you know the story of McDonald's, right? So you maybe you've seen
the real estate. I've seen the movie.
Yeah, you are not in selling business. You are in financing business, and you need to know how much you are financing, because that's all you are doing. By buying these lots, you are financing the inventory. How are you financing? You're financing them through your earnings. But what is that relationship? How much you are financing versus how much you are earning? And if the difference is not within your power to finance, you're going to start to choke your business.
Yeah. So the good thing is our business do not have any debt. That's why I'm pretty much comfortable. I'm giving those numbers because those are the profit distributions out of the business, and business can still be running itself, self-sufficient, paying the rent, the payrolls, the cost of goods. So that's why I feel more comfortable. But you still made a good point.
It's a nice metric to track. Because, you know, I talk to sellers. In your case, there is a huge advantage because you're not in the inventory management business. You are more in the numbers management business. So if you were in inventory management business, let's say that you make, I don't know, fancy candles, and then you give an order to the factory and the factory ships, you know, I don't know, 100,000 units to you. You need to know how many pieces are you selling per day. You need to know how many pieces are at Amazon. You need to know how many pieces in your warehouse, if you have one, or a 3PL. Mm-hmm. And you need to know how many pieces are on an open PO. So that way you can say, okay, based on my performance, I need to order more, or I have enough, or whatever. That makes it much harder for businesses. And a lot of the sellers, believe it or not, don't have anything in place to track this.
So
they don't know. They don't know any shortfalls. In your case, you don't have these issues. You don't have to track.
We don't have to track, because this is the disadvantage of my business model, because we do not have replenishment. We do not know what we are buying, and we cannot request any items from our suppliers, and they do not give us manifest files what we are receiving, because we are purchasing 30,000 different SKUs at a time, and our only 1% of the inventory is more than one copy, and our in-stock rate is around 8 to 9%. So there is no way that we can do replenishment.
This is
the disadvantage of that.
But we
do new listing instead of replenishing the items we have sold before. We replenish some of them by unintentionally, but we do not make any requests to our suppliers that we want those items.
Yeah. All right, cool. This is, you know, this could be for the listeners, this could be an alt for anybody who is doing online arbitrage. This may be another option. So what I understand also when you and I talked, you told me about your system. So I understand you also, other sellers can subscribe to your service to do this sorting. Tell us about what you actually provide for other sellers.
Sure. So we have, before we creating Books Pro, we have used many other softwares, inventory management, listing, repricing, customer service. And some of them are great, but expensive. Some of them are cheap, but giving good service. So we had to come up with a system that we can use, and we created Books Pro. It's the product suite. It's the software that a bookseller need, and this may fulfill their all software needs. They can use that when they're sorting products, getting at a thrift store or a bookstore to sell online. And they can use that to list their items online. The advantage of having that all at one place, because it's all integrated, it's saving a lot of time. So when they scan the item, they can see if they sold this item before. When they are listing the item, they do not need to manually input the price because they have the automation rules on the other part of the software. So we are giving a lot of advantage to our clients to save some time, increase their efficiency.
So does your system also offer those options? You know, FBA will make you so much, FBM so much, and
yes.
Okay. Yes. So anybody can do this, really. Anybody can go source books from same kind of places that you are sourcing, and then with your system they'll be able to tell how much they're gonna make and then ship it out to Amazon FBA and then
they can see how much profit they can make, and they can do the listing very fast. They can have automation rules to determine their prices competitively, and they can optimize their profits, maximize their profit. And also we have some clients that is non-book category. We are still improving that software to other categories as well. The arbitrage, still arbitrage, not private labelings, but not in book category. We are still implementing in process. It's still in process. We have some clients that is not in book category.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, I would say for anybody to do this, it's an easy situation, except that it's a finance deal. So what is it that you're buying? And then what is it that you're making? And therefore, make sure how much you're holding. And anybody does this, it's as long as it's manageable, it's a good business model. Frankly, yeah. I prefer this to online arbitrage, because in online arbitrage, you always have the risk of being stuck with inventory you paid $100 for, and now it's selling for $65 by the lowest guy, who probably is using a repricer and who probably didn't even know how he repriced it down so low.
Yes. So for this business model, they do not need to start with that model in the first place. They can start selling the items that they already own, like the books, and they can go to the neighbors. I have acquired a lot of books for free. You can just put an ad on Facebook, Craigslist, that you can haul away their books for free. They have a lot of books. And you can go to estate sales, thrift stores, library sales, and you can, so they are selling it for $1, sometimes for 50 cents. And the prices are like $50, $100. So there is a very high margin of error even if they are not used to the structure of the Amazon, they can still make money and they can learn by doing some mistakes at this stage of the business at very low amount of inventory. And it's very easy to source, very low capital required, very high ROI, and there is an existing demand for them. They do not need to make any marketing. They do not need to create like PPC campaigns and hope for they will get very low ACOS. So they don't need to worry about those. They just acquire low and sell high.
Yeah. So it's definitely an option. Well, this was great. So we learn about your business. Now let's learn a little bit about you. So tell us, let's start with the early days. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Turkey.
What part of Turkey?
I grew up in the, I was born in the east side, Middle East side of Turkey. And then I moved to Istanbul, Turkey for high school and college. And then in 2014, I came to the US when I was 21 to study computer science. And then 1 year after that, I started selling on Amazon to be able to pay the tuition with my classmate, current business partner. And then I've been selling books since then.
So what I want to know is, how does someone who grew up in the eastern part of Turkey, middle to eastern part of Turkey, which is not anywhere near Istanbul for anybody who knows the geography, but for the listeners' benefit, it's very far. It's not like
600 miles from Istanbul.
Yeah. I mean, it's a long way away in terms of lifestyle. You know, lifestyle is very different. So how does someone who grew up in that part of the country ends up being an entrepreneur in the United States? That's what I want to know. What drove you to this? It cannot be just computer science.
For high school, I was enlisted to military high school in Istanbul. That created a great vision for me. And I studied in Istanbul, and then I had to drop out because of some health issues from the Air Force Academy. And then I made the decision to pursue computer science path. And I made a lot of researches about where can I study those. And then I applied some schools in the States because my goal was to get into Stanford or MIT. But after I came here, after I made the researches, I realized that it's very hard to get in. And it is, even if you get accepted, it's very expensive. And then I chose more moderate college, which is University of Missouri. I studied computer science there, yes.
So it's okay to study computer science. It's understandable why you chose it. But running your own business, that's a whole different ballgame. So how do you go from computers? Because computer science people are fairly methodical. They're not really enterprise oriented. So how do you go from studying it to becoming an entrepreneur?
So the current circumstances back in the day, the struggling part made me choose this path a little bit. So I tried to sell other products as well. I also tried private labeling as well, and I have two failed attempts on private labeling. And so books was easy for me. It was more convenient. And I thought about scaling this up in a very big scale. I started like selling a couple books a month. Now we process over 100 tons of books weekly. So it worked pretty well for us.
So it was financially driven.
Yes. So after college, I didn't have any experience to. I'm also a software engineer, but I do not have any experience work at a company as a software engineer.
So after graduation, so just as an option, so you came here to study, then, you know, a graduate from a U.S. university, a college. Now, obviously, with the experience, spending time in the U.S., back home, you would have a lot of opportunities. So how do you choose staying here versus staying here and then starting a business with a lot of struggles versus going back home to a nice, you know, welcoming kind of environment with a potentially good job?
So it's a pretty funny story that when we started this business with my business partner, so he's classmate, we were classmates since high school. We studied together, we started business together, now we are running it together. We told each other that don't get appealed by the money from the business. Our main purpose is focus on our college and we will pursue academics. But then, like running business, seeing how scalable it is, encouraged us to pursue this. And also having innovation, merging my field of study, computer science, into the business, made me realize that we can scale this really big. So we pursued this path.
So really what I'm hearing is it's not money that is appealing.
It's not money.
No, no. You know, it never is. That's what I was trying to get at.
Some part, some part it's money. Some part it's accomplishment. I'm living very moderate life. Like, I pay, like, my expenses same every month. But what I'm looking for is more accomplishment.
Yeah, yeah, that's the driver. So, yeah, I'm glad you said that. I mean, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking, okay, how does this guy go from here to there? And what's driving you is to create something big, to make something big. It's that sense of accomplishment in creating something out of nothing that is not a small thing, but a big thing. And that is what I'm getting. So my next question is, where is that coming from? Why? I mean, because a lot of people don't think that way. So why do you feel that you want to have something big?
That's a great question. I don't know. I don't know the answer, but you know, it feels right. Yeah, I should think more about it, but it feels right when you accomplish something, when you, because it motivates me. If I do same things every single day, it may not motivate me to go to work, go to my office, but having like each day different than the other one is motivating me. I really wonder what's gonna happen next day, what we are gonna accomplish next month.
So you want the unknown.
Unknown, but potential accomplishment.
You know, there are no guarantees in life. If there is an unknown, God knows what's behind that door, right? So you may run into anything, but you still open the door and you walk straight through, even if it's a bad thing. And that is the accomplishment. Even if it's a bad thing, knowing that you'll be able to walk through it and then figure it out. I have a question for you. So growing up, do you have any brothers, sisters?
I have a brother.
Are you, what is the age? Are you young one or older one?
He is 5 years younger than me.
Okay, so when you were a kid growing up, have you been told you couldn't do this, you couldn't do that, or not?
No. There was no discouragement. So I was very good at my classes, so I was not told any of those.
So there is an author. She's now dead, long time, but she was born in Russia and she was very smart. And she left Russia and came to the United States. And she always knew she was very smart, and she would put books on her desk in the in the classroom, stack books up all the way up, so that she could hide behind them when the teacher was teaching, so that she could write her novels. She was writing novels when she was a kid. She didn't need to listen to the teacher. She didn't need to do anything. But of course, if she appeared to be not listening to the teacher, she would be scolded. So therefore, she would stack up books just to be able to hide behind them and then write her novels when she was 10 years old. So this woman came to the United States, and because the Russian Revolution had just taken place, they lost everything. And she came to the United States because she thought that she could do better. So, and here she became wildly famous. Today she has an institute in California that lives after her. And she's become a philosopher, wrote many books. But she always knew she was the smartest. She was very smart and she could do better. So your story reminded me of her a little bit. So you are doing this because you feel that you can, because you know you were always good at things, but you want to know why you are chasing after these accomplishments. That's something I leave you with.
It's funny that still my mom and my grandparents are encouraging me, hey, you studied engineering, you are a software engineer, why don't you go apply for a job, they have really nice salary, or just come back to Turkey and work here. They started to understand that I invited my mom this year. She saw our operation and she saw how big. Actually, it's not that big comparing to like mega sellers on Amazon, but relatively big. She started to understand you just stick with it. What you do. I know my backup plans. If I got really discouraged, I also know that I can still be software engineer, even if I don't think that I would pursue this now, but I still have a backup plan. Yes.
Yeah, well, no, you can't. I can tell you that. You can put that out of your mind, because once you become an entrepreneur, you know what entrepreneurs are called? Unemployable. Because we don't like to listen to anybody. So entrepreneurs are unemployable. We either create operations of our own, build it, and work on it, in it, around it. But
working or stay unemployed.
Yeah, stay unemployed. We are unemployable. That's what entrepreneurs are. So
that's a great approach.
Yeah, well, so this was great. So tell us how can people reach you, and anybody who wants to pursue this business model, give us your contact information.
I can give you my contact information and you can put it in the below. Or they can go to Books Pro and fill out the contact us form. Or you can find me on Instagram at BookUpCycle. You can give me a follow. I sometimes share some reselling on Amazon content when I have time. They can reach me.
Great.
At any platform.
We will put your contact information on our website. So anybody who wants to reach, you'll be there. But now also, I wanted everybody to hear. So this was great, Omar. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah.
No problem. Oh, if you wanted to, everybody to hear, I can give my phone number. It's 314-624-8100. Yeah, they can text me if I can take the call.
That's very brave of you. You are the first guest ever that gave his phone number. So that was very brave. Thank you very much. And thank you for
hosting and inviting me again.
All right. It was my pleasure. And this brings us to the end of another episode. And I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.